Go ahead.
Yes, so Avanish Basudev Sharma from NICAF. So I think you mentioned this, but it, very briefly, but it went a bit too fast for me, so I want to get this clear. I have four small questions which follow up on each other. So the first one is, what is the current experimental uncertainty for Higgs production?
For Higgs production?
Yes.
What do you mean, in the cross-section or what?
Both of
because it depends on which production process you are looking for.
So if you're looking at inclusive production?
The overall inclusive production, yeah. I show the table. It's some percent.
Percentage?
I show the
10
table
or,
for
or
yes,
one
all
or
combined.
Right. And then if we were to go to the high luminosity LHC, about how much would it shrink?
How it would improve?
No, but how much would the uncertainty shrink, the experimental uncertainty?
Yes, it depends. There are some projections, in particular not on this yet, because we will have to, for some of the production processes, we will have some improvements in the sense that you have, of course, higher statistics. That's the main point of high luminosity LHC. But together with this, we will have also a higher pile-up level. I didn't explain what is pile-up, but I just said a few words very fast. I profit now to explain better. When the proton bunches are crossing from the two beams, what is interesting for us is the so-called hard collision, besides the fact that there are people who are interested also in soft collisions, but they said most of us are interested in hard collisions. But what happens is that also the other quarks which are inside the protons crossing may interact, exchanging gluons, and these gluons can make gluon splitting and produce quark anti-quark, which can then also emit gluons. So at the end you have a lot of tracks around which are not belonging to the hard scattering process. And you can have also something overimposed, which is, for example, interaction between also different protons from the same bunches. Mm-hmm. So the environment, let's say, it's not clean at all. If you know what was going on at LEP, which was E plus E minus collisions, it was something beautiful because you knew exactly the center of mass energy, the collision point, and what was colliding, the electron and positron at a given precise energy. And that was it. Electrons and positrons are not composite particles as protons. When you collide protons, you collide actually quarks or gluons, which momentum distribution is guided by the parton distribution function, so you don't know exactly what's smashing, and also which particles exactly are smashing, you have just a distribution of probabilities. Yeah. And on top of that, as I said, it's a very harsh environment. Now, at the very beginning, LHC was coping with 10, 20 of these pile-up events. At the last time of this round two, there were 14 average with a peak of 60. And for high luminosity LHC, we will have 100. So if you see, for example, a screenshot of the tracks which are produced in one collision at high luminosity LHC in the, let's say, closest detector to the collision point, you see thousands of tracks which are giving rise to exactly 100 vertices which you have to reconstruct. There are 100 simultaneous collisions even. And you would say, okay, that's impossible. I can tell you that when I was working as a student at CDF, we were very scared to have two collisions at the same time. In ATLAS and CMS, along the years, we get used to have a few tens, and now we are quite sure and strong in our self-confidence that we will be able to cope also with 100. Let's hope it's true, but let's say we know.
Thank you. So the third question, is there a difference for these projections for CMS versus ATLAS?
Let's say, more or less are the same for what projection can be relevant. So if there are differences, are very small differences, because in a projection, it's not that you can really calculate the impact of each systematics, how it will improve. More or less, the main point is that, especially in the case of the high luminosity LHC, you will have an increase of statistics, so you know how this will improve your statistical error. And on top of that, normally, this is done since the time of Tevatron, you assume also that having more statistics, you will be able also to build more rich control samples, which allows you to calibrate the detector, to study the background in depth, and so on and so on. So based on this assumption, more or less, at the end, the predictions are more or less the same.
Okay.
If you ask me if the systematic uncertainties are treated in the same way in the two experiments, I would say not really, not always.
All right, so the last question. So how do these projected uncertainties compare against the theoretical uncertainties for the predictions?
Sorry, how these...
How do these projected experimental uncertainties for the...
For luminosity LHC or...
Yeah, so how do they compare for the to the theoretical uncertainties for the predictions of X production?
Ah, okay. Well, as it was in the past, we are putting theory in stringent corners more and more. I was mentioning today exactly the measurement of the anomalous non-magnetic moment, which was measured at the G-2 experiment, confirming the previous measurement at Brookhaven, and giving a tension with a standard model of 4.2 sigma. At this point, when the theoreticians saw this measurement, they started to review the hadronic QCD loop quantum corrections. Mm-hmm. And immediately after the paper of these measurements, experimental measurements, a paper came out with new calculations of quantum loop corrections, which were reducing this tension. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that it was just one group, and there are now other groups which are and have to confirm these new calculations. One part, because these quantum loop corrections are made of two contributions. One is, let's say, the vacuum polarization, coming from vacuum polarization, and this is the part which has to be more solidly stated by let's say, other researchers. So. It's a continuous exchange between the experimental measurements and the theory. There are some measurements which are already having an experimental uncertainty which is smaller than the theory uncertainties. One example for all is with a top mass measurement, we are really interchanging continuously the record of the smaller uncertainty between theory and experiment.
Yeah.
And for the projection, there are some measurements which will put theory in the position to improve the calculations. Again, I'm speaking about some years ago, but not hundreds of years ago. When I was looking at the top, there were just leading order calculations for the main background, W plus jets from QCD. Nowadays, for many, many processes, including this background, you have next to leading order calculations plus correction and so on and so forth. So there have been step ahead incredible, driven by also our experimental results.
Okay.
And again, of course, we are pushed by theory when it gets nice hints or improve the prediction.
Great, thank you.
Another example is the W mass.
Okay.
Yes, at some point you mentioned that a too large top mass implies a metastable universe. Can you explain why? Is it because of the running of the Higgs coupling or something like that?
Okay, this was explained by Professor Toft in the first lesson. He was mentioning this plot, which is also a bit of a debated plot because this gives you the relation between the top mass and the Higgs mass. And the top mass intervene in the vacuum of the Higgs through the radiative correction. So what you see in this plot is the higher the top mass, the more you move toward an unstable universe. But, and Professor Toft knows better than me, this plot, at least the one I showed, is done in the hypothesis that the standard model is the theory, so it doesn't include new physics, which could change, of course, the picture. Am I correct? At least the one which I show implies a standard model as the theory, without introducing new particles or new corrections.
Well, this, of course, we don't know, but the standard model is, well, what we understand now about neutrinos and everything else is all included in what I call the standard model. It does not contain supersymmetry, it does not contain many other things.
Yeah,
it also does not yet contain the couplings that would turn a Dirac neutrino into a Majorana one. So,
and this is not always said when this plot
but
is
that's
shown,
what I call a standard model, but you had a different way of
naming it. But in my plot, I'm sure that it's just standard model. I was wondering whether yours also was just standard model.
So the standard model, as what I just defined, could still be true, because we haven't yet discovered the double beta decay. If we haven't discovered double beta decay, that would falsify my definition of a standard model. But again, that's a definition. So the same discussion as just before. You can name things differently, but you can also look at the physics. And if this interaction takes place, a double beta decay, that would be an observable thing, then what I define to be the standard model would go down the drain. There is something that we don't, that we haven't yet seen before.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Francesca Ercolessi. Okay. Since you mentioned that the RAN 3 is approaching, my question is if the ATLAS and CMS experiment underwent any major upgrades during the long shutdown too?
You mean the next long shutdown before iLuminosity LHC?
No, this one.
No, of course. Both the experiment went through upgrade. I can tell you one which was quite relevant for us is the new small wheels for the muon detector. So we increased the redundancy of the muon system with these new detectors. On top of that, there were some replacement and some reparations for the part closer to the beam pipe, the inner tracker, because this is done for both the experiment with pixel sensors, and they are subject to a lot of radiation damages because they are very close to the collisions. There were some changes in the electronics as well, in the muon system, trigger. So there have been changes, but not as drastic as the ones which we will be performed for preparing the experiments to iLuminosity LHC, where there will be really big changes.
Hi, this is Daniel Kinchesh, and my question is, what role could the upcoming heavy ion program play in new physics or beyond standard model searches?
You mean for ATLAS and CMS?
Yes.
Well, I didn't exploit it in my slides at all, the heavy ion studies, but even ATLAS and CMS are doing heavy ions physics. And it's not just a small activity, albeit there are few people involved. I should remind that the first jet quenching plot has been done by ATLAS, and also the first ridge has been done by ATLAS, also CMS got a nice result. Of course, we are not specialized for heavy ions physics, because our detectors are not done for this. But we can do something, and I show also with the example which I gave you of the photon-photon in tau tau, that something completely new can be done. So we prove that we are able to look at heavy ions physics. The problem we have is that it's a very restricted group of people who is working on that. So. For example, speaking about new physics or something which can bring to new physics, we also studied top production with heavy ions. That was very interesting. Yeah, we are doing fancy things now, knowing very well the detectors. We can play. Please.
I'm Eric, by the way. I was wondering what the status on like this Di-Higgs measurement is, and if it's on the horizon for run 3 or if it's more of a HLLHC like 300 inverse femtobar or 3000 inverse
which
femtobar.
We study, sorry?
Or like Higgs self coupling. Like Dihiggs stuff.
No, this will be, these are studies which require high statistics, so high luminosity LHC will be the place where to do more. Of course, we will improve a little bit also with the next run, but as I show you, the next run will give just twice the statistics we have now, so you can do better. The important point is if we are able to be smart, because I already show you many examples in which with the same statistics, in fact, the analysis were very much improved. Nowadays, the scientists which are working to this analysis are mostly big experts of statistics. We are using multivariate analysis, boosted decision tree, neural networks, so all statistical techniques which a few years ago were looked at like monsters which nobody knew. And nowadays, having the ability to handle statistics at this level allows you, even with the same statistics, to do much better analysis. So I wouldn't exclude that people looking back, even at what we have done up to now with the same data, can do better.
Right. Yeah.
Hi. Sorry, Khadija. So I have two questions. So I think you mentioned that there are two approaches for the searches regarding BSM physics.
Regarding?
BSM.
BSM.
Yeah. So previously, I think you mentioned there would be like a prediction for a specific phase space point, and then you'd look for that. And whereas now you have a more model-independent approach where you kind of uncover a lot of data, and then there's post-analysis. By, I don't know, maybe phenomenologists, would you say that will be the continued approach in future runs? Or?
So the first approach which you mentioned, the one to look at specific models and even a specific point of the phase space of that model, was what we were doing at the beginning when mm-hmm. we were very confident of supersymmetry popping yeah. out immediately. After a while, and after having spotted many mm-hmm. points in the phase space, we decided it was much better just to look at the final state and then exclude whatever it's allowed with this final state limits which we get. So this is considered at present the best approach, unless we are proposed a model which looks extremely appealing. Like, for example, I show you that many supersymmetry limits have been transformed in dark matter limits because the final state from the phenomenological point of view was exactly the same. There are some analyses instead, not very much at present, that are referred to a specific model. Like, for example, these long-lived particles, which are a bit new. People are very curious, and they really want to look at it in detail, at the very beginning, at least.
Okay.
But the general philosophy now is to do, as I said, look at the final states and then go back
exclude,
and exclude
like
whatever we can exclude.
Okay. I just had one
question. Or discover
question.
Something, often.
Yeah. For the leptospheric quarks, I'm not too familiar with, but would the existence of these type of particles lead to any kind of barrier number violating processes, and how constrained that would that be for the parameter spaces?
Even for the leptospheric quarks, there are several models. I saw that they are foreseen in several theories which have different characterization of these leptospheric quarks. So I was referring to a model in particular which is very much looked at in these days, which is the 4321 model, which mm-hmm. I explained a little bit without going too many details because I'm also not a theoretician. Let's say this is very much appreciated because a vector leptospheric quark could explain the tension in the B physics measurement, which we'll see in the next days with the LHCB summary, which Professor Giubellino will make. And this this has been reintroduced, let's say, in our activities exactly to explain these tensions. So besides the 4321, there are other models which foresee inept quarks. Some of these models were already excluded in the past, because, as I said, the leptoquarks are around since 40 years, even more in the experiment. They were looking for leptoquarks at UA1 and UA2, to say, and not found. But, now in this optics, they could appear, you know, together with these vector-like leptons, which are also included in the model as the lightest particle of this 4321.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, so I want to ask about the Fowler physics facility. I think it will use some of the remnant particles from the ATLAS.
The
phaser, for example, experiment.
Phaser.
So I would ask, I don't know if it already start taking data, but I want to ask if the data analysis is being made like a combined analysis, because I think it would be important to know, like detect the particles in the ATLAS detector, for example, and then make a combined analysis to this long-lived particle,
yes,
BSM search. So I don't know if this is happening or it planned to happen.
Well, people are discussing. At present, RAN 3 started in the sense that, let's say, there were collisions already at 900 GV, so a lower energy in the center of mass. We checked that our detector is working, nothing is exploding, and so on and so forth. And in a few days, the 5th of July, we will have stable beams. At this point, ATAS, CMS, and also phase will take useful data. And yes, the idea is to look at things together, yeah. So there are a group of people which are interested also to the across the experiment analysis which are discussing, but it's still to come because phaser is a new experiment, it didn't take data before. So I can tell you that for the moment the performance of ATAS and CMS with the new beam are the ones expected. There are already a plot of performances, I mean, reconstruction of electrons, jets, muons, all the objects which we use for the final state reconstructions are working nicely. And I think also phaser has already some good results. So it will be interesting for sure, yes. That's a good point.
Hi. So you saw the plot with the couplings of the Higgs to the quarks, and the big quark had a much bigger error bar, if I remember correctly.
Which plot, sorry?
In the plot with the couplings of the Higgs to the quarks, and the big quark coupling had a much bigger error bar. Does this have to do with...
Indeed, the error were not really in proportion. They've been taken from a different plot, because the biggest one was for the muon, and you didn't see it. So it has a bit of error in the coupling, yes, because in principle, Higgs would really like to decay in BB bar, because it's the heaviest one. We saw also the top, but let's say Higgs decaying to BB bar is favored, because B is heavy. What is the problem? Is that this final state, albeit, let's say, favored, is completely sinking under the background. We have a huge amounts of BB bar events which are coming from QCD. And you have to clean up all the background to see the Higgs signal. And the cross-section of Higgs in BB bar, it's good, the branching ratio of Higgs in BB bar is good with respect to all the other lighter quark decays, but it's extremely smaller with respect to QCD BB bar production. So this is a bit of a problem for the measurement.
And will this be improved in the next?
Well, we are refining all the techniques. I didn't tell you because it's in this context is a bit of a detail, but big quark are fragmenting and showering in our detector. But before doing this, they can travel a little bit. So you can see a jet coming from a big quark fragmentation, slightly displaced from the main collision vertex. This is the way we can reconstruct jets and identify them as jets from B fragmentation. And we are quite expert now in doing this sort of identification, also because we have a very good tracker, both ATLAS and CMS. The CMS tracker is better. I say because I know that there are students from CMS. The tracker is better, it's true. But this is also implies some uncertainty, of course, in the identification.
Thank you.
So you mentioned those Higgs decay with measurements.
Yes.
And do I understand correctly that this kind of technique would not work to constrain like the Higgs to invisible width that would be visible in like lepton colliders and so on?
No, I don't understand.
Like you cannot, with the technique you mentioned, you can only
you mean the
measure the total width of the Higgs.
The on-shell of shell.
Yeah, that one, yeah.
This is what you
yes,
mentioned.
Yes.
No, I was saying that the width, the natural width of the Higgs is very, very small. It's something like 4 MeV with a mass which is huge. It's 125 GeV. And it's much smaller than the width of, example, of the W, which is 3 GeV. So the natural width of the Higgs cannot be seen with the resolution of our detector. It's impossible because we have the resolution of 2-3 GeV, so we can't see it. It's completely destroyed by the detector resolution effect. So this technique to, let's say, compare the number of off-shell Higgs and on-shell Higgs, make the ratio, and you get out something which is the width, was suggested several years ago by, it was in a theory paper, and it worked quite nicely because, as I said, the off-shell part does not depend from the X width, and while the peak, it does, of course. So the first one was CMS, which excluded completely the hypothesis of absence of off-shell of the off-shell distribution, and then ATLAS made another measurements afterward, improving the uncertainty on the width. Of course, here again, more statistics, better precision. So the RAM 3 will be very interesting also in this respect. And maybe we will find also another way, who knows.
Real quick, I'm interested in anomaly detection stuff, and you mentioned like anomaly detection for like direct observations, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about like the methods that they use for anomaly detection. Like you said, extra energy in jets, I believe. What other
there are several systems. I was mentioning the possibility to detect directly a new particle. This is what you are referring. Anomaly, you mean some new particles, some
sure.
new effects.
Yeah.
The long-lived particles are the perfect example of this because these are particles which in principle you could see directly. The problem is and also, let's say, their good point, but also their difficult point is that they leave a very distinctive signature in our detector. And what is nice is that they can leave, according to the different type of long-lived particles, strange signal in different part of our detector. So I made two examples, one showing long-lived particles which are able to decay within the tracker, the closest to the beam pipe detector, which is done, as I said, of silicon sensors. And these tracks appear at a certain point of the tracker after having crossed a little bit, even 50 centimeters, without problems. And you measure the DA and DX, so the release of energy as a function of the cross distance within the detector. How do you do this? Well, the particle cross the pixel sensor and leave some energy. The sensor, you know, how does it, they work, the silicon sensor, no? When a charged particle cross the silicon sensor, they produce electron hole, and about 80 electron holes are produced per micron. So at the end, finally, you get some current. Usually, you collect always the released energy as current or as light, that then you transform in current. So usually, this particle cross not just one pixel, but several pixels, which form a cluster. You sum up the energy released in all this cluster of pixels, and divide by the distance crossed within the detector, and you get the DA and DX. And the DA and DX of this particle, as let's say predicted by the theory, is much more higher than for the standard model particle, which we know. So in this case, you use the pixel detector. Then another example was the liquid argon electromagnetic calorimeter. We can see photons in our electromagnetic calorimeter, and these photons, if they come from a normal X, are emitted in a certain way at a certain point in average within the electromagnetic calorimeter, starting from the interaction point. So if you reconstruct the direction of the photon, they really come from the interaction point. If they come from an exotic Higgs, as the one I saw that the case in some supersymmetric particles, and then produce this displaced photon, the photon does not point anymore to the center of the collision, but it's displaced in the beam fine. And you can see clearly that it's off from the usual distribution position. And there are also long-lived particles of muon type, which you can see in the muon detector. So we can really use in a completely different way all our experiment. And here you can see really directly the things. What is missing yet, it's a good calculation of the timing, because, for example, in the case of the particle, which is a huge DA and DX, I told you that they are slow, much slower than the light speed. At the present, our resolution in measuring the time is not so good. For the next upgrade, the one in preparation for Illuminosity LHC, we should have resolution uncertainty on the time measurement of 30 picoseconds, and things should be much easier. So.
So this is it for today.